Welcome to Mecha Do About Nothing, the only mecha podcast capable of firing Zeronium alloy rounds. I'm your host, Ian Gregory.
And I'm your host, Daniel Forziat.
And this week we're on to our very first manga, which is kind of crazy that we've never done one before, but we are covering Naoki Urasawa's Pluto, and we have read the first 23 chapters, which is the three volumes.
You say that it's surprising that we haven't done a manga yet, and yet we haven't done even close to the majority of mecha anime yet.
Well, I don't know. It makes sense that we'd want to, you know, freshen it up, try out other stuff.
We have had like the idea of doing a manga before. We've toyed with the idea. It's tough.
Mecha is really an anime heavy genre, right?
Yes.
All the big stuff, all the famous stuff is anime. And Pluto barely qualifies as mecha.
Well, if you watched you'll know it's a mecha.
We reached a maybe controversial decision that Brando piloting the giant bodysuit qualifies in some degree as a mecha, right?
Yeah, which is I think about that more now. Maybe that's a hot take, but whatever.
All right, so Pluto. There's a lot to get into here. Pluto by Naoki Urasawa was released monthly from 2003 to 2009. It is 65 total chapters. We're covering it in 3 weeks. 23, 46, 65. That'll get us around 23-ish chapters a week. Dan just had a look of recognition on his face. Or a yawn, I couldn't tell.
But both.
Naoki Urasawa. So Pluto is an adaptation of the world's greatest robot arc of Astro Boy, which is about 160 pages in Astro Boy, released in a magazine in the 60s. Astro Boy, of course. So in a way, we have two creators here. We'll start with Urasawa, who is one of my very, very favorites. He's done my favorite manga ever, 20th Century Boys, as well as Yawara, Master Keaton, Monster, Billy Bat, and a bunch of other ones as well. He's had a long, long, long manga career. Probably Monster is his most famous work, I think. It's got an anime. Have you? It's about a serial killer and a doctor. Dan, no recognition whatsoever.
If there's something I don't ingest at all is manga. I don't even watch normie anime. I'm subjected to that, like, not by what I want. Like, every time I walk by a pachinko parlor, I just see some stupid new anime that's got a pachinko machine. Like, that's how I learn about anime.
The real Japanese.
And so manga is just like, it's just, whew, that is not it. Wow, I'm out of it. If it's not Dragon Ball or Yotsuba, man, I don't know anything about it.
That's so funny. I read way more manga than I watch anime, because anime takes way more time for me. I can read manga very quickly. I've read like almost everything on the Shonen Jump app. I have read a disgusting amount of manga. Right, I read new things. I read old things. It's a lot. So that's so funny because I definitely do that. Wow. The only anime I watch is for this podcast.
Wow. So we are completely different ends of the spectrum, because I also don't watch anime either. But like, yeah, like I think I can name all the manga I've read on like maybe one hand and two hands.
Wow.
Probably.
Wow.
I've only read Rurouni Kenshin all the way through and Yotsubato. Isn't that crazy? Maybe it's not that crazy.
So our other creator here, though, for the source material, is Osamu Tezuka, who did Astro Boy, Phoenix, Buddha, created the modern concept of anime and manga as they exist today.
Yeah,
probably one of the most important people in the history of manga of all time, right?
I read through his Wikipedia page recently, as an intellectual does.
Right.
And he, man, what a crazy dude. So he like started off like, he's like, yeah, I'm going to just work a real job. And then, very uncharacteristically, he quit and was like, yo, mom, I'm going to just make manga. And she's like, you know what? That's not a great idea, but you should do what you want to do. And good thing he did it, because he's the biggest guy ever.
Probably, like, alongside, I don't know, Go Nagai, he's probably the one person who's responsible for the most, like, for the development of what we think of today as manga, right?
Because, yeah,
course, he's not the first Japanese person to make comics. Of course not.
No.
But the what we recognize as manga is really the result of Tezuka's work.
Yes.
And I mean, as early as, like, you know, 1950, he did Kimba the White Lion. 1952 is when Astro Boy started, which is, of course, one of the most famous manga in the world. It has major crossover appeal in the United States. But importantly, Tezuka died in 1989. So he died, 15-ish years before the series started coming out. Urasawa had to convince his son to let him do an Astro Boy adaptation, which took some doing, and then his son looked over the scripts and advised Urasawa on what to do. And Urasawa picked this arc because he read it as a kid, and he misremembered things from it. And he's like, he thought it was a different story, and then he reread it and was like, oh, I just, like, invented a new version of this in my head because it's been so long since I read it. And this is really an Urasawa manga. It's got all his hallmarks, all his character designs, all his storytelling. This is a very, like, classic for the way he writes and draws, and it's all of his themes. But it's definitely playing on Astro Boy quite a bit.
Yes.
I love this manga, to be clear.
I like obvious. The redesign of Astro Boy a lot. I'm going to refer to him as Astro Boy, because that's...
I'm going to call him Adam.
I had a PS2 Astro Boy game, man. That game was sick. You just, like, fly around and stuff. I think I unfortunately sold it to GameStop, but if I can find it again, it was a fun Astro Boy game. And that's, like, the extent of Astro Boy I've been exposed to. I think I watched a little... Did it come to, like, Cartoon Network or anything? I feel like I had seen a little bit,
there was a reboot.
Though.
There was, like, a movie in the mid-2000s. Must have been the
reboot.
There's a lot of Astro Boy content, okay?
Yeah.
There was a 2003 Astro Boy series. Maybe that's what we saw growing up.
The timeline there works.
Overall, though, Dan, what did you think about this? So this is going to be interesting because I have read this before, and Dan has not.
So, sorry to our fans. We have not been doing a lot of mecha over the past few weeks. And so you sort of told me, like, preemptively, it's not really a mecha. And I know what Astro Boy is, so I kind of understand that. I did not expect it to be this, though. This is, like, cop, crime, mysterious killer, action mystery thriller thing. And I'm like, okay, this is cool. But, like, way more intense than I was expecting in the Astro Boy universe.
Yeah.
And I also thought, like, misconception, I also thought Astro Boy or Brando was going to be the main character, because we kind of talked about them, like, a few weeks ago. Yeah. And then this German robot dude, whose name I will need you to say first before I say it, because maybe, I just, you know, I think you should say it first, that's all.
Gesicht? When I found Gesicht? Out, yeah.
I don't know, I'm not German.
I think it's Gesicht.
I just keep saying Geist in my head. I think it sounds cool. I'm going to call him
Gerhard Gesicht. That's his name.
Okay, Geist. Anyhow, Gesicht. When I found out he was the main character, I wasn't, like, put back or anything, but I was just like, oh boy, here we go. Like,
yeah.
I don't know. It's all new to me, so it's like I'm trying to take it all in. And I know this is a little long-winded, but so far it's like the writing style and the way it goes, it's seeming to flow well for me. I'm not confused too much. They introduce new characters at a very good interval. Sometimes it's a little murky when you get, like, these weird side characters that, like, might be important, might not be. And also, because it takes place in Europe, but also in Japan, we have a lot of dramatically different names for a lot of very similar characters, which is, like, mostly policemen and Interpol agents or whatever, maybe not Interpol agents, but, and then, like, scientists. So it's always like Dr. Miyamoto and Dr. weird last name, Scheidenfold. And
Dr.
Like, oh,
Abracadabra is one of the characters in this series.
So anyhow, but again, so far, overall feelings is it's been good. Like, it's now that I know what I'm in for, my expectations are set straight.
Yeah. All right, I'm going to get into the summary here.
What about your overall feelings? Oh, wait. It's
I love it. This is literally one of my favorite series.
Summary's good.
Mont Blanc, a Swiss mountain robot and one of the most powerful robots in the world, is found destroyed and desecrated. Gesicht is a hyper-advanced robot police officer working for Europol. He is summoned to the scene of a crime where he determines that a human has seemingly been killed by a robot, which is supposedly impossible. Gesicht later comes to suspect he was killed by a human, but one who possesses inhuman capabilities. Gesicht goes to interview Brow 1589, the only robot known to have killed a human, but one who was determined to have no programming defects. Brow hints that the most powerful robots in the world are being targeted, including Gesicht himself. We then see North Number 2, another robot, living with a composer before being hunted down by a mysterious assailant and destroyed. Gesicht goes to warn Brando, another powerful robot, who is a pro wrestler, that they are being hunted. Brando willingly ships himself out to the coast of Turkey to fight with the assailant, and seemingly defeats him while being destroyed himself. Gesicht consults with Adam, another robot, and they investigate another human death, seemingly by the same robot. Both human victims thus far are pro-robot rights activists. Adam determines that both victims were members of the Bora Investigation Squad, a group of academics sent into the country of Persia to determine if they were manufacturing robots of mass destruction. Though the Bora Investigation Squad said they were not, the United States of Thracia insisted they were and commenced with an invasion, backed by the power of the seven most powerful robots. Gesicht discovers flaws and gaps in his memory and is haunted by a recurring dream. We also learn that the United States of Thracia appears to be run behind the scenes by a giant immobile robot. Dr. Abracadabra, a Persian scientist, is warned that his life may be targeted as well. We are also introduced to Adolf, an anti-robot supremacist whose brother appears to have been killed by Gesicht while on duty, though Gesicht has no memory of this. Adolf intends to hunt down and murder Gesicht. We are also introduced to two last robots, Epsilon and Heracles. Adam's robot sister Uren discovers a lost and homeless robot, who she helps nurse back to health. This robot reveals he has the power to make flowers grow and to change the weather. Dr. Abracadabra sends a robot made of roaches to retrieve this one, and it is revealed that this is really a spare robot body being possessed by electromagnetic waves. The radio waves return to their original body, that of Pluto, the robot responsible for killing the world's greatest robots. Whew. It's kind of hard to summarize a mystery series like this. I'm glad that they reveal that Dr. Abracadabra is up to something at the end of this block, because otherwise I would have had to have mentioned him and then been like, no reason.
Yeah, right? He's just a character introduced, and then that's it.
Yeah, and there's like a whole bunch of other scientists who are introduced in this portion.
Yeah, that's the struggle part.
Dan, do you have any highlights? You didn't write anything down.
So I have an anti-highlight, and also, you know, I was busy when you were writing the highlights, so... I'm going to have my anti-highlight first.
Yeah.
I want Japan to stop making manga and anime about the conflict in the Middle East and about the KKK. I'm sick of it. I'm sick of my culture being appropriated.
Shouldn't say that. I've got bad news, too. The robot supremacist's name is Adolf.
It's like... I get it. America has a lot of very... interesting, unique things that are
tactful way to describe that are white supremacy.
Unique to talk about. I'm kind of trying to lump the two together, the Iraq war and that. But like, I'm just a little sick of just seeing Japanese anime with dudes with KKK masks. It's like, yeah, all right.
I mean, remember, this is random though, and that is dumb. But remember, with the respect to the Iraq War, this is written in 2003.
I know. So like that, along with like a lot of other stuff, like that makes sense. I get that.
Yeah.
I guess it's more the KKK thing I have the issue with. It's just like, all right, yeah, I get it. We got white supremacists in the United States. All right.
Yeah.
You don't have to remind me Japan, right? Japan.
In this case, it's kind of a weird combination because Adolf is a combination of like neo-Nazis and of the KKK, right? Because he's a German named Adolf, but he's they also dress like the KKK. So it is like a combination. I mean, neo-Nazis and the KKK are like the same thing anyway. But the point is, it's like an interesting combination of those two. Rossawa writes about neo-Nazis a lot, though. Like, they turn up in a lot of his works. But they feature somewhat prominently in The Monster, for example.
Okay, maybe it's... again, because of the current political climate, but I'm just a little over it. I don't really want this in my Japanese sci-fi / whatever.
It hits differently, like, I think when this stuff came out in the 90s and in the 2000s. And then now, I would argue that we've been almost overexposed. Because it's sort of come out of being a fictional thing, and now it's something you see in the news. It's a little... I don't have a problem with
it's real again.
I do see what you mean.
It's... Yeah. I know. Sorry, but that's my anti-highlight. Not that I particularly cared about that, but when I got to the point where they're like literally wearing the things, and I was like, first big fire, then
it's
this.
It's a lot coming off of Giant Robo. All
right, sorry. You can go over the actual highlights.
I've got a few highlights. For me, one is a funny story mostly. So it's Gesicht is in Japan. And he turns the corner and he sees a boy like looking at a bug, and he's like, oh, you're Adam, aren't you? And that's our first look at this version of Astro Boy. I really like that moment because it's just a cool design. It looks good. And you're like, oh my God, here he is. Like, finally, here's the main character. And when I was reading Pluto originally, I was not aware it was an Astro Boy takeoff.
Oh, really?
I knew it was by Urasawa. I had never read Astro Boy. I didn't know this was an adaptation of an Astro Boy story. So when I hit that page, I literally went, what? Like, I went like, wait a minute. And then I looked it up and figured out what it was.
I guess
it's been a while. It was a really interesting exercise. So
when they localize Astro Boy, I know this is going to be a really stupid question. How do they reference Astro Boy in Astro Boy? So, do they call him Adam or do they call him Astro Boy? I thought they called him Astro Boy.
They call him Astro Boy, but in the Pluto adaptations, in the English official English localizations, they call him Adam.
So that makes sense why you would not immediately understand that.
Yes.
Because like Mega Man, they just call him by his name, Astro Boy.
Yeah. But I immediately got it when I saw the panel that said, oh, you're Adam. I was like, that's Astro Boy. Like, I knew immediately. But I had to look it up to make sure, like, why this Astro Boy was in this manga by Naoki Urasawa.
That's a good point.
But, yeah, I really like this version of Adam. I think it's really cool. And it is interesting. Like, I don't know. There's a lot of great scenes with him. Because he is a super genius, right? He's a robot. But he's also a kid. And he's also, like, very human.
Yes.
Is it North number 9? I said number 2 in the summary. North number 9, the guy who hangs out with the composer and wants to learn to make music.
Yes.
Those two issues, very touching. I loved those. And really sad when he dies and he's singing that song.
I like when he takes the cape off and he just has weapons.
Yeah, that's an impactful moment. You're like, oh, he really is. He has killed like a million people. Or he can't kill people, but he's killed a lot of robots. Yes. Which, is there really a difference, especially to a robot? Then I just love Brow 1589, this decrepit, horrifying robot with a lance stuck in him. And if they take the lance out, it will kill him. But they leave it in him because they're trying to understand how he could possibly kill a human. And he just sits in his jail cell and laughs at Gesicht all day.
And he's like, give me your memory chip. Yeah.
What a creepy, creepy character. He's really effective to me.
Yeah.
All right. Let's move into our discussion, Dan.
Okay. Let's do it. Guide
so
me.
So first of all.
My lord.
This is an adaptation of The World's Greatest Robot from Astro Boy.
Something I have not read.
I read it after I read Pluto. I do think it's interesting because you'll go read it and you'll be like, that's it. Like, this whole thing is based on just this. It's a very straightforward story.
Okay.
And it will mostly make you be impressed that Urasawa got to this from that and still retained so much of it.
Okay.
So the characters carry over. All of the quote-unquote greatest robots are the same, obviously. Even though they have mostly complete redesigns, like Epsilon just looks like a person in this one, but in the original he has like a goofy hat and like weird attach. You know, they're more
looks
cartoony
like
characters.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
And so this is Urasawa loves writing about conspiracy theories, detectives. He's got a noir style. 20th Century Boys also has a giant robot in it, by the way. But that's a really conspiracy theory heavy manga, and there's like an interesting combination of his grit and how he makes characters look kind of ugly or human. Do you know what I mean by that?
Yeah, I was thinking that where I and maybe this is like supposed to happen,
mm-hmm.
but Gesicht, Adolf, and the one guy who goes to Japan, mm-hmm. They all like kind of have the same face. But it, like, kind of makes sense, right? Like, having two European older gentlemen, you know? It's like, oh, you know, of course they're going to kind of look similar, right? In a very human way. It's hard to explain. Like, they don't have the stupid tiny little nose and the big eyes and whatever. Like, typical anime way. The characters feel, while still looking very much like manga and anime, have a very good sort of realistic art style for the medium, if that makes sense. You know, they're not like caricatures. They're proportioned pretty well.
So there's very little symbolic representation in Urasawa. These characters have human facial proportions. Uh-huh. The eyes, especially, you know, that's always the thing with anime, right? The oversized eyes or the small noses. He loves drawing characters with big noses, prominent noses. I think that's a signature. He loves drawing people with small eyes, intense. I'm just looking right now, I'm flipping through some pages, and yeah, lots of different hairstyles. I think there's a huge range of representation in his characters that make them really compelling, and it makes all his work feel very real.
Yes, these people that's sitting a good around. Point.
There's a very, it's like just a crazy contrast between, you know, the Astro Boy setting, probably one of the most classic, timeless, happy-go-lucky versions of science fiction, right?
Uh-huh.
And, like, these really sad, grim characters watching their friends get murdered. Yeah, I don't know. I like that contrast. It adds something, I think.
This is a really somber, melancholic sort of manga. I keep wanting to say show, but yeah. It's really, like, there's nothing really happy at all. There's a little bit with North, kind of
almost that gets to be happy.
That it sort of gets dashed away. So
I love that the way this plays with Astro Boy, you know, probably especially to Japanese readers, one of the most recognizable properties. And it takes like these designs, but like I said, I who did not know this was an Astro Boy adaptation, had never read Astro Boy, got to the page where Adam's introduced and knew it was Astro Boy. Like, that's really important too, that he doesn't give up on what makes the setting so distinctive.
I love it because like the Astro Boy like franchise, I don't know what you would call it, like the Tezuka franchise, is a silhouette like symbol of Astro Boy's head, and it's just like you see that and you go, you're like oh yeah, that's Astro Boy, like, and it's like, but it's so weird because it's like, even for us, where that's not like a huge thing, it's still so recognizable. And so for Japanese people, it's probably like the most obvious thing in the world. Like if we saw Amuro Ray in something, right? It's like, oh, that's Amuro Ray.
There's a lot of like cute little references too to other Tezuka stuff. So there's the underground doctor that saves the composer's life. That's a reference to Blackjack, the underground surgeon. And then there's a Urin, like when all the lions escape, when we're first introduced to Urin, she's like, oh, especially that white lion, which is a reference to Kimba the White Lion.
Oh, I didn't get that series. But that's very smart.
So I don't know. How do you think knowing that this is a take on Astro Boy changed the way you read this?
So I think, as I said before, I thought it would be more lighthearted.
Sorry. Maybe I didn't prep you properly for what Pluto was.
Yeah. Like. But now again, now that I'm kind of in it, I get that like anything can kind of happen. Just judging by the fact that so many robots have been slaughtered so far. And I don't know.
I mean, in some ways, the original story is fairly grim because those robots were destroyed in the original, yes, right?
That's a good shredded point.
This makes things a little more grotesque because it makes the horns out of their body.
And yeah, mutilated bodies.
But I don't think Urasawa is wrong in remembering the story as being dark. Especially if you read it as a kid, he'd be like, that was kind of depressing.
Yeah.
So he made something that's depressing as a kid into something that's depressing as an adult. There's like a direct transmission there.
Yeah, maybe it's just that I haven't been exposed to any Astro Boy. Like, really. Like, I can talk about it like I do, but really, there's, you know, not nearly as much like as in Gundam and stuff like that. So I think maybe that's helping in a way where now I have like these very, at first I thought it'd be lighthearted. Now I think it's going to be definitely dark. So maybe, I don't know. It's easier for me to change my mind or something. I don't know. Cause like if I knew something differently, I'd expect there to be like a twist at the end or like, but I have no preconception of any of that. So I'm just sort of taking it chapter by chapter.
Sure. So, okay. So this is really an Urasawa show because he loves thrillers, mysteries, conspiracy theories. That's what this is. And we do have a detective main character. This is something of a detective story.
Yes.
And there are a lot of questions that get raised. And what I like about this is that I think writing a fantasy or science fiction detective story is hard, right? When you write a detective story like Sherlock Holmes or any of these classic detectives, the laws of the universe are clearly established because they're the ones the reader knows, right?
Yeah. And someone, they're based on reality.
They're shot by a gun or they're hit in the head. In this, when you're writing a fantasy series, you're like, oh, he died in a mysterious way. You're like, well, what are the rules? How could someone die in this universe? Like, what kind of magic is there? What kind of science fiction is there? It's harder to like establish how the rules work, so that sometimes when you reveal how someone dies, you're like, well, of course I would have never thought of that. It's magic, right?
Yeah, like, maybe this isn't the right term, but like, it's so easy in these situations for like a deus ex machina to sort of like pop out of nowhere, because you're right, like, oh, well, it turns out that robot can transfer his brain to another thing right before he dies and he's not actually dead, haha. Like, but we don't know that. Like, that's, and that can come off stupid. It's like, ah, oh, what a gimmick, right? You know, that's lame. Yeah. But you're right, we're like, in Sherlock Holmes, like, the dude gets shot in the head. He's dead, you know? He's not, you know, like, it was a body double and he used, you know, it's like, that can't happen.
That's a classic, though, the body double or the twins thing. However, I think where the series succeeds is it sort of has two questions. It has a whodunit, and it also establishes the rules and said, well, how did they do this? Because we learn that that robots can't kill humans. Robots don't kill humans. So you're like, well, how? But someone died in a way that could only be done by a robot, right?
Very so iRobot like, oh. inspired.
Yeah.
Yeah? Wait, what? Whoa. Let's not gloss over this. You know iRobot, right? This is what this is probably.
Yeah. Okay, I understand what you're saying now. Yes. Like the book,
the movie?
Yeah. I'm familiar with the books.
Okay, Which are very, predate this by quite a long time,
and,
right?
By the way, Asimov wrote murder mysteries with those detective characters. Those classic iRobot books, like Naked Sun, are all detective mysteries about how robots could possibly kill humans.
That's kind of, because my uncle really liked iRobot, so that's kind of like where I like instantly went with this when they said that. Like, robots can't kill people, they're made not to, and it's like, but they probably can, right?
So right. You get like, how they? Right. Yeah. So, but I like this because it sets up the rules and it says, well, how is this possible and how is it done, right? There's like two questions we're getting at here. I don't feel like they've sprung anything on us that's completely ridiculous just yet, right?
Yes. Kind of.
I mean, there's still robots, but so in the beginning, at least, there's a lot of classic detective work, like Gesicht getting the memory chip from that person.
Yes.
And reviewing the tapes with his wife. Really tragic scene as the wife robot just stares forward and like processes that her husband is dead.
Yeah. And then she's like, wait, what's this? And they like look at this little like speck on the screen, and it's a dude jumping from like a building to building. Yeah.
Yeah.
And they're like, how did we miss this? And she's like, what did she say? It's like really sad. She's like, only,
I don't know exactly.
Only saw, or I don't know, but it was like in a way that like only she could see it because she knew.
Only saw it because she had the memory chip in her brain. You wouldn't see it watching it on a recording, but she had it and she felt the way her husband was looking at it.
Like, yeah. Like his last moments. Which is like really cool. Yeah, because for some reason they make like a really weird remark where they're like, only a human could do that. And you're like, wait, what?
No, it's not that, it's that. She looks at it and says, he looked at this and realized it was a human.
Or yeah.
Like, robots can instantly distinguish between robots and humans. And so he looked at it and said, human, which is what makes it so strange.
Yeah. Where you're like, wait, what? We got a little super villain from Giant Robo over here who can jump from rooftop to rooftop and destroy robots.
I think that's really good how they ground this in like established detective tropes. And then build it up into this bigger action thing. And I like that there are these competing mysteries. The humans who are dying and the robots who are dying. Seemingly in the same way. Especially with that tornado, which we're also curious about, right?
Yeah. Like, I like it because, like you said, there's like these very like patternistic killings that kind of make it more interesting and also easier to follow. Where tornado appears. Either a human dies and they get horns stabbed into their head or next to their head, or a robot gets obliterated and like their parts get turned into the thing. And it's like this like calling card, not really, well, calling card, kind of calling card thing, where people are getting murdered, and like they do that cool thing where they have a copycat murder where they're like, nah, this is not the same guy. This is just someone using the serial killings. Horn. To throw us off, you know?
And I really like that Pluto, the actual giant robot, is hidden from us, right? We don't actually see anything about what it really looks like until the very end of chapter 23, where he comes out of that lake. So it's kind of like a horror monster thing, too.
Yeah, and it's really scarily depicted.
Like, yeah, that thing, you're like, ah,
yeah, this robot, this
robot unsettles me. Do we also, that is in the section, right, where we meet Epsilon for the first time, right? And oh, he tells us about the kid who he takes care of, right?
Yeah, he is a pacifist because I guess we kind of like didn't really talk about like the big backstory other than Ian's description, but there's a huge war that almost all of these super advanced robots fought in except for Epsilon, because he's like, no, I'm not doing it, like a conscientious objector. And instead, he now takes care of war orphans from the war.
The Persian War. And so, and also worth noting is that Adam didn't join the war until basically the fighting was over. Because they didn't want him to or something. Because like, it was considered bad to have the kid there. But then they brought him in to boost morale. But Epsilon also says, I became very unpopular for refusing to fight in the war. Which is very much like a Dixie Chicks sort of thing. Maybe a weird comparison, but you know what I mean by that, right?
Yes.
They came out against the America about against the Iraq War, and they were like lampooned. They were panned. They were so. Anyway, that also though, there is that scene where he's like, my kid. He has this vision of this giant robot, right, moving in the distance called Bora. That's really spooky too. There's like a weird element of horror in this series.
Yes, and like the way that like. Mysteries overlap because like he says Bora, right? He goes like Bora or whatever, but Bora is also like the name of like the investigation squad, right?
So how did they know or something?
Yeah So it's like, wait, what is, yeah, like what's going on there? Like there's clearly gonna be like that, which I love in mysteries. Like I really like spoilers. I really love Ace Attorney, and I really like Professor Layton, and I really like Danganronpa. So this is actually kind of up my alley. And I really love that like 80% of the way through the story mark where you get like the huge reveals of everything. And I'm like really excited for that. So like all of this kind of like building up to like what's gonna happen here, like what's the big mystery behind what happened in like the Persian War, and why there was like a giant catacombs of destroyed
of
robots.
Dead robots,
like
yeah.
That kind of stuff. I'm like, yeah, I'm just like, I can't wait for it all to connect, like the line to go through every single one of those things, and like bring us to like the end of the mystery.
Yeah.
So cool.
So let's move more into the general and talk about like our setting here. Cause this is a distinct, you know, I don't know. It's a really interesting blend of Astro Boy and like geopolitics. Cause there's like the European Union and Europol and the Iraq War and all that stuff all at once. So
there's like, a lot.
What the basis of this society is robots, obviously, but there's a lot of interesting stuff. Robots can't kill, but they can be judges. There's a robot judge who they mentioned gets blown up by a group, right?
Yes.
And there are robots in every job. There are robot police officers, robot cab drivers made, like everything seems to be doable by a robot. They're not just like servants. Though they also seem to be servants. Like there's like an interesting.
Yeah, it's. Like we see that Geist, we see him and his wife live like a very simple good life. She's sort of like a stay at home mom, and he, I don't know what she would do. I guess cooking and cleaning. And then Geist is obviously a detective, and he goes and does his like crazy stuff. And they, again, they live like a life.
They go on vacation.
They're trying
to go on vacation. It keeps getting interrupted because Gesicht has keep having work to do.
And the question I have for that though, which you kind of talked about, is Gesicht forced to be a detective? Was that like, was he programmed to be that and therefore he has to? Or does he have a say in that? And maybe I'm looking into it a little too far, but you're right. Like we have like, it seems that they're real people though. Like they have real say in what they do and real autonomy. But
they
don't
have
know.
Interior lives, right?
Yeah.
The robot cop who's killed in like issue one or two has a wife who clearly cares about him.
The name.
And so, but there's also like Adolf's robot maid. She's like, ah, she's getting old. We need a new model. You don't say that about a person, right?
Yeah. Oh, you could.
You wouldn't say to your human maid like, oh, she's getting old. We need a new one.
I bet old maids are the nicest too.
Of course, Adolf obviously doesn't treat robots very well. Considering he's a member of the robot KKK, but
I actually already, I think he treats robots very well for how he is a member in the
hates them.
Like,
yeah,
You know,
but a lot of that seems to be him wanting to keep up appearances in society, right? He seems like, he's publicly very magnanimous and equanimitable, but like in private, he's like, oh, these robots, because one of them arrested his dad.
Even like super privacy, because it appears that his wife and child do not know about that either.
Though he does say things to his son, like, we learn about robots because we hate them or something. Like,
I think he says because you have to or something. I don't think he says hate.
Yeah.
Because when they get when. Oh wait, actually, hold on.
Oh.
Sorry, I'm like thinking, I might think, I'd be thinking a little bit of ahead because I accidentally.
So
read
ahead. Dan accidentally. Never mind. And I read a bit ahead too. So.
Never mind.
So, the point is that robots seem to exist in all levels of society. There are robot law jurists, like people who write robot laws, yes, and robot rights activists, and robot hate groups. So yeah, in some ways, they're treated like, you know, like any minority that are like just now coming into their full legal rights.
Yeah.
And they're also relegated in some ways to these service jobs. But,
and we see this time and time, like, this is a very, I won't say this was tropey, but this is like,
it's a classic. You,
Detroit Become Human is like the exact same.
Detroit Become Human is like a terrible version of Pluto.
Okay. First off, don't say it's terrible. Okay. You can say terrible version, but Detroit Become Human is probably David Cage's best game.
That says so little.
As someone who used to live in Detroit, it very accurately describes my life. All right.
No, it doesn't.
But we see this, like this.
It's a
allegory of like what you said. I don't know if it's allegory, but this it's comparison of a minority group, very but much like becoming normal.
Like there is like a sense of new model robots are more human, right? So the scene I love with Adam is when Adam and Ern are leaving the police station, and they make robots walk through one hall and humans walk through another, which is also really interesting. And he goes to walk in the robot hall and the cop goes, no kid, you gotta go in the other one. He's like, nope, this is for us. The robot one. And the cop is like, wow, you really can't tell these days. Implying that robots are getting actively more realistic and the less realistic robots are older. Or are they just cheaper, right? There's like a, how are robots made? Maybe we're thinking too much about the specifics of it.
Yeah, and like it seems that there's like a standard issue police model, because we see a lot of like the similar looking robots working for the police, where they've got like the very round oval head kind of thing and like the
cool looking heads. But here's another interesting detail. So the homeless robot that Pluto possesses that becomes friends with Uren, we learn that that's the alternate body of a big construction robot, right? And it shows up and it's like, that's my civilian body. I lost it a few days ago. Because robots can transfer between bodies. Do you think that all of these working robots also have human-shaped leisure bodies? Or is that a luxury you have to purchase?
So first off, I thought that it was bull crap. When that labor robot comes by, I was like, that's a lie. That's no way.
That was a lie?
I was like, that's not his body. That, there's something going on there. Whatever. Maybe I'm looking too far into it. But that's a good point. Like, maybe that police robot...
That we're talking about on the job look like that
just to help distinguish, but it doesn't make any sense because his wife looked exactly the same as she had that body in the home.
Yes, so but it makes sense to me. Maybe robots who make a lot of money, save up, can buy themselves a more human body.
And yes. This is a hard thing to grasp, which is interesting because it's kind of fun, because like this could be our future. Probably won't be. We'll be dead before.
I mean, there's also this whole thing where we'll get into the more weapons of mass destruction thing, but we know that they're not allowed to make more robots like Gesicht with Zeronium frames.
Yes, because they're considered like WMDs, right? Essentially,
because they can fire Zeronium alloy rounds, which are like hyper explosive, deadly. And we see Gesicht fire one, and it blows his arm off, right?
Like I imagined, like his arm was the round, right? Like,
yeah, maybe that's what it was. It's crazy. Also, the fact that Gesicht's hand can morph into like a pistol, pretty scary.
It's scary because the first time I saw it, I was like, that's disgusting. Because it's like his fingers like turn into a barrel. It's kind of grotesque.
It's very, there's a recent manga called Jagan where the guy's power is that his hand can turn into a gun. And it looks exactly like that. Except that's more of a body horror series. Like, they're not robots.
Body horror is not something I'm a fan of.
I love it. So, the other thing here is this blurring line, like we said, between human-like robots like Adam, and then there's the robot-like human, Abracadabra, whose body has been replaced by robot parts.
Right? Yes, and he's the system
automatically flags him as a robot.
Yeah, where he's got a human brain. He was in a big accident, and so he's like, actually.
Well, I think he was in the Persian War, is the implication.
Oh, well, that's an accident, if you look at it a certain way. Yeah, he's like, yes, I am majority robot, but you can't tell.
Yeah.
Not like our boy Adam Jensen.
And it raises this other question, Brow raises this too, is like, is a robot capable of killing just a human? Is a perfect robot a human and therefore capable of all of the things a human can do? And is a robot that can't kill just a robot and only, like, you know, just not a real person?
Uh-huh.
But we also know that Gesix can dream. Lots of robots can dream, it seems like. Like, there's all of this interesting stuff about, like, this blurring line between human and robot.
It's this really weird thing where it's like their AI is clearly... Mm-hmm. much more powerful than a human brain in some ways, yeah. Right? Calculations, like figuring stuff out on the fly. Like, he can look at a crime scene. Watch
Adam do that crime scene reconstruction, right?
Yeah, which was, like, crazy.
Follow me, mark. It's really cool.
But then you also have that thing where, like, Adam pretends to have human emotions.
And he tastes, he loves to eat.
And there's, like, a complexity that if you, like, really think about and get existential about, there's a complexity there that is something that... may be more, in fact, complex than any AI can ever have, right? The way you feel emotions. And it's like,
But also, if you hard to get into your entire life perfectly mimicking every emotion in every situation nonstop, what's the difference?
Right, exactly. Like, if they react in a very human-like way to a situation that is still new to them, then aren't they just...
It's really, like, it's
aren't crazy. They just doing the thing, right? They're just being a human. So it's crazy.
All right, next. This isn't really a mech series, but...
No, it's not. Ian tricked you all.
The robot stuff is related to the mech stuff, but how do the questions change, right? Like, what's the core genre differences? I have prompts, too, if you can't think of anything else.
Yeah, like, I think the core... Like, we still have that thing where there's clearly... There's two different things going on. Like, in Gundam, we have Amuro Ray, and we have his Gundam. And they're both very important to the series, but they both fill, like, very different roles. Where I think this does the same thing. We have humans that are a little bit of afraid of robots. There's killings going on. Robots are very powerful. Then there's robots who are also kind of afraid of humans, very good at fighting. There's a whole war that involved them, blah, blah, blah. So we still have, like, the double dynamic thing going on that I think helps. If we don't have robots or we don't have mechs, it's just humans. So it's sort of like, it's like I don't want to say it's more basic, but it loses a layer of depth. Where I think that is very similar. I think it's different because now we have robots that are sentient, that are almost human-like, which then is like if the Gundam is in reverse, not...
Right?
Yeah, right. So that's where it's like things get way different and kind of confusing.
So if you can trade down to more human bodies, is it like after fighting, the Gundam dresses up like a human, right?
And he's just Amuro.
It spends its time pretending to be a human in the same way when a human gets in a mech, they are pretending to be a robot. It's not about humans that become stronger by assuming the robotic form of themselves, but humans are sort of being replaced by robots, or humanity has another, like, being to coexist with. Mm-hmm. I think I really like what you say. Is it in reverse? Is the Gundam becoming the human instead of the other way around?
Yeah, it's... I still like how we have, like, the second thing that's, like, our mech, right? We have that second thing with the robots, and I think it adds a lot to the show. Like, obviously, the show is about... Or, the show. The manga is about this whole robot conflict mystery thing, and that's really cool. And I think it would be less without it. Similar, like, how mech shows are lesser without mechs. Where, like, if this was just a standard murder thing, or not murder thing, murder thing. If this was a standard mystery where there's a Middle Eastern war, and after the fact, this guy's going and killing these famous
soldiers.
Like, soldiers. Yeah. It's like...
The seven greatest soldiers. So lame. No, the robot stuff is really crucial, I think, in the story. And agreed. He really... Urasawa hits every possible angle of this robot society thing, right? He's not just having robots in it to have robots in it. He's like, what does having robots being alive mean? What does it
Which
mean
is
to war?
Like, racism mean? Against robots. Like,
yeah.
Having to do all this crazy technological stuff. Like,
I mean, guys getting repaired and stuff. I have to talk now about robots of mass destruction, that phrase, right? That's wow. Really on the nose.
God. I was just going to say 9/11 really shaped our world in more ways than anyone expected.
But I really like this because mechs are also weapons of mass. They're weapons of mass destruction, obviously. Yes. One gun
for sure.
They could turn the tide of an entire war. And I like that he's like, yeah, imagine the way this wouldn't work is that there aren't soldiers who are by themselves capable of destroying cities, right?
Yeah.
But the robots are humans. They're people. They have emotions and they raise kids and they want to go on vacation. And
everyone just wants to go to Japan, man.
But it also raises this question of who's allowed to make these robots, right?
Yes.
And you're not allowed to make them anymore, but the ones who we already had are allowed to stay alive. But if you weren't one of the countries that made them when they were illegal, when you were allowed to, then you're screwed.
It's like and these nuclear sanctions we have.
Yeah, and if you try to get on a level playing field, they're going to deploy their robots of mass destruction against you to make sure you never catch up.
Yes.
There you go. So I think that's a really cool metaphor. I think the Iraq War metaphor is really on the nose, but I like this idea of this robots of mass destruction thing. And I think that's a natural extension of this genre.
I also like where we are in relation to the geopolitics, where we have these two, I want to almost say abstract sides. I don't want to put it that way, but we have the United States
of
Thracia. Sorry, my R's in the
By the way, part. It's insane to me that every country has the same, except for Iran, which becomes Persia. I mean, it's an Iraq thing, but Iran is what's considered Persia. And United States of America, which becomes the States of Thracia. Was he just not willing to make it explicit, or did he think that was, too raw?
He should have just done it, because he was so close. Yeah. Putting United States of...
We know. And there's, an election or something on camera, right?
Yeah.
So they have this whole thing. Even looks like George Bush. The president even looks like George Bush.
To finish what I was saying, I like how we have the United States of Thracia and Persia, but this does not take place in there at all. It takes place in mostly Europe and mostly in Japan, and that adds a level of sort of indirectness to all of this as well, without being stupidly well, let's just go to Persia and solve the mystery. It's this huge global conflict thing or mystery that's going on.
Yeah, and I mean,
it's adds to it, I think.
The war was between Thracia and Persia, right? They said, we even though the report says there are no robots of mass destruction, we're going to invade Persia, right?
Yes.
And they dragged the rest of the world into it. All of these extra robots from around the world had to go to fight on the benefit of Thracia. So it's only fitting that this is a globe thing. They were all pulled into this conflict that never really concerned Gesicht on a personal level, right?
Uh-huh.
But he's part of it, and he was in the war, and so was Brando and Heracles and Norse and all of them. So, I don't know, I just think that's really interesting. And you're right, that having them play it out across the world instead of just going to one of these countries to solve the mystery is way more interesting and feels way more real.
Yeah, when this opened in Europe, I was like, oh. That's not a normal thing to have happen in a manga or anime. It's
Urasawa loves Europe. He has a lot always of Japan. Europe, but yeah.
Or I guess sometimes it's also in America. There's a lot of either.
No,
or
you're
really.
Right. But Europe is interesting. In the Middle East, especially rare.
Belgium, right? Because it's
Brussels, right? That's the center of the EU. So
yeah, So Belgium, right? Am I wrong? Oh my god,
Brussels is in Belgium. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, thank God, I've been there actually.
Me too.
Fun fact.
So,
oh my gosh.
Last question before we move on to our robot corner.
Brussels Eskimo Prince.
Dan, where do you think this is going? I of course know everything, but
oh sure. I think they're gonna play this exactly how I want them to, and I feel like since you like it and I have faith in it, I think what I said earlier, I'm gonna get a very good Professor Layton cross Ace Attorney thing where
you're gonna get the moment where it all clicks.
It's gonna be I want it to be the 80% mark, because I want that nice they figure it all out, we got it, then the last 20% is stopping whatever the final boss is, you know what I'm saying, and then the last little bit is sort of the resolution. I think that's the perfect pacing. As someone who does not do any writing or make anything of the sort, I think that's perfect. And I'm hoping that's what happens. I'm hoping maybe the next set of chapters we read is building, solving a little. I think solving a little bit of mystery every once in a while helps feed it a little. It's like, oh, we discovered what this is. And I want it to get to the climax and then sort of kind of go from there. The climax for me is when it all gets figured out. Is usually kind of how the climax is for big mysteries. I assume they're going to have to stomp Pluto somehow.
At some point.
But I'm not really looking... Like, I don't really... I shouldn't say this. I don't really care about that, though. Like, Pluto's cool.
It's not about
cool.
the fight, right?
Yeah, it's really not about the fight. It's about fighting. The mystery. Like, what's happening? That's what I want to know. That's the huge climax for me. Yeah. So, predictions... I bet Geisicht is Pluto.
Okay, no. Moving on.
I don't think that can happen, but it would be cool. He's an unreliable narrator. He's actually been him the whole time, killing everyone. Pow. Oh, so, also, the mystery where he's like, it'll be 500 Zeus, please. And it's like, that needs to be solved quickly because I'm going to lose my mind. Because that happens like every chapter now. He's like, that'll be 500 Zeus, please. And it's like, he's like freaking out. What's happening?
All right, let's do the robot corner.
It's hard.
A lot of our robot, I don't want to confirm or deny anything, right? You got to be true.
Yeah.
In the mech corner, robot corner, a lot of our robots are just humans. We see them in humans. We see Brando in both the human body, where he's a little overweight. He's like a happy looking dude. And then he gets in his big wrestling body. And then we see Heracles getting his like God of War style, like literal God of War, like not the game, but it's, you know, it's got the heroic.
Yes, I have played God of War on PlayStation 4.
Okay, let's start with Geisicht, who just looks like the most boring man. He's balding.
He's like a European older dude. He's got kind of like the sad face. His like eyes are a little droopy, and he's just like, he's got his nose is just a little too big, like you were saying. Very European looking, always frowning or like resting sad face, you know. He's like never smiling ever.
Yes.
Unless the person he's talking to is about to get killed in the next following chapters, then he's smiling because he's always like, "Oh, Brando, you're so happy with your family. That's so nice." And then
yikes,
and he dies.
So something I love about like their human designs is that they can still do robot things. So there's the scene where Brando is fighting Pluto and Geisicht is hanging out with Heracles in Greece, and he just turns and he's like, open a line, and he starts shouting like, Adam, take a look at this. And on the other side of the world, Adam is like, you need to look at this, you know. Like, they have this instinct, like there's still things happening behind the looks that are inhuman, which are really great.
Yeah, because like, of course they'd be connected to the internet or whatever network, right? Like, that, why wouldn't they be? Like, they should have like this whole encyclopedic knowledge of the entire history of the world, right?
Yes,
easily.
And the same thing applies to Adam's design, which is great classic take. He's just a kid, but he's so smart. He always looks like he knows more than you, which is a tricky thing to give a kid, right? Next, Brando, we talked a little bit about. Urine is a lot like Adam. Brow, whoa, creepy, right?
Yeah, I really, like you're saying, I love the setting he's in, where they have like the anti-tank pillars,
all those pipes and stuff.
They have like anti-tank pillars, which he's not a tank. So you got to get like through this debris, and you got to put, if you're a not an advanced robot, you have to put on a special mask to block electromagnetic interference, because he'll like hack you, or something.
I love how terrified they are of Brow, and he can't even move.
Yeah, and he's like, he's dead basically. Like,
yeah,
he can just stick his arm out to get a memory chip. That's like all he can do. But it's just like, you're right. It's so funny where he is so horrifying that people just don't even get near him. They just keep him down there.
No, they can't understand him, and that's what scares them. Yeah, what a cool design, and the way he just sits there with his head tilted and the spear coming out of him. I want like I want to know what happened with him in the past.
It's like the Lance of Longinus, dude.
It totally is, dude.
Maybe actually, maybe spoilers. Is. Got it. Geis is gonna pull the lance out of him and throw
second
it up
third
and
impact.
Kill Pluto. Yeah, he's gonna kill Pluto, who's flying through the stratosphere.
Oh, no. Let's see, who else to talk about? North, number 2 or 9 or whatever.
I actually did not like this probably as much as normal humans should like.
You did mention liking the moment he takes his coat off.
Yeah, like, I thought... this. Okay, so sorry. When we get... there's a little bit of story. The first time we get introduced to North is the first time our story, like, does a blip away from the main story. And I don't... yes. I can't, like, describe that. But it's been geist, and you just think, okay, the whole story is going to be from his viewpoint. And then we get a point of view shift immediately to something else, which for good reasons, because we get introduced to essentially Pluto. And that's what caught me off guard, where it's very slow and melancholic for a reason, leading up into like this like little mini big climax, which I was confused about the first time I read.
Yeah. I think you're right that it's abrupt, but it's also important because it's the first chapter that really shows us what, like, how human the robots are, right?
Yeah. I don't like North's...
his design is a little weird, like, with the arms. Yeah. I like him with the coat and, like, how he just wants to sit there and he plinks his little robot hands at the piano. It's
yeah, a great that's image. Cute. Yeah.
Mont Blanc, the Swedish robot we really only see in flashbacks. He's got, like, a very Astro Boy design, right?
He's very derpy looking. Yeah. I like it because when he dies, again, these are a little bit story, more story related than design related, but when he dies, it's like a global mourning for this
everyone's
dude.
So sad. Like, it's really affecting when the guys are watching the test screen at that memorial and they're all crying.
This is like reminds me, like, what if Smokey the Bear was like a sentient being that like
yeah,
we could go visit as kids, and then Smokey gets like shot by a poacher. It's like, what the heck? He's Smokey's dead. You know, that's like kind of this. Also, Smokey was a war hero. That's right. A little weird to me.
That contrast is so. Mont Blanc is like the mascot, right? He's built to be lovable and friendly, and he's a rescue robot. He saves people, but also we see him in a flashback in Persia, and he killed like 8,000 robots or something.
Yeah, which is like very. Says a lot about, I guess, like the situation that they're in.
Yeah.
But like very interesting. And I'm sure that that will be more explained too, because you're right. The book starts where he's already dead. Like they're investigating his death. And I think that's going to be like a very crucial point. Like, how did this kind of all begin? Like, what happened with the fight between Mont Blanc and Pluto or whoever killed him?
So lastly is we get our first real look here at Pluto at the very end of this block with the just coming out of the lake. I don't know if there's much to say about his design because we really don't see much of it, but it is spooky. He's got teeth, it looks like, and he's got big horns.
Yeah.
And he's screaming. He goes, ah, yeah. When he comes out.
I don't know.
You don't have to, like, say anything about this, but...
Clearly he's... probably from the Persian War for Bora Bora invest. Like, there's like, I don't know what's going on there. Maybe he was the weapon of mass destruction that they made in secret. Maybe he's not. Maybe he's a cover up. Who knows? That's what I'm excited for. That we still have like absolutely know nothing about Pluto, but we're finally getting like the little tease, right?
Yeah.
Like it feels like every time there is an event that involves Pluto, we learn just like a crumb more, right? But that crumb is very helpful. Like, yeah, we got to see him a little bit, but like we don't know anything else. So maybe next time we'll see a little bit more, or we'll find out something different. So I'm excited to learn more about Pluto.
When I was trying to decide how far we should read, I realized that like almost every chapter works like a cliffhanger. Like, you could stop reading in almost any chapter and be like, it's really strung together masterfully. Urasawa knows how to write a mystery and thriller, right? This is his wheelhouse, so he really gets how to make that function. All right, final thoughts, Dan?
I think I've already kind of described how I feel about this, but I'm liking it. I'm enjoying it. It's a pretty easy read as long as you do the thing where you mentally block out a lot of the side characters and don't get hung up on them. As I said before, a lot of European names and a lot of Japanese names because it takes place in both areas a lot, and there's a lot of like police assistants and police detectives that are not necessarily seemingly important. So I think what I've been doing is sort of putting them off to the side and mostly just focusing on the robots, like our big robots that also die very quickly, and like try to remember at least what the people look like that seem to be important. So like Abracadabra, I kind of forgot who he was, but like I remember what he looks like and I remember his shtick, right?
Yeah.
So not a terribly difficult read, which is what I was a little bit worried about, because Ian, an intellectual, is very, his brain is capable of more analytical millions of
calculations
things.
A second. Yes. Yeah.
So at me, at a mere mortal, it's very difficult to keep up with him sometimes. So you can really, but I'm excited. I want to see what happens. The fact that you love this, and we've hit the singularity point already, means that I think I'm going to like it too. So I'm excited. I want to learn more. What are your final thoughts, Ian?
I don't know. It's fun to reread this, right? From this perspective, reading it slowly instead of just flipping through it again like I've done in the past. This is my first like real full reread since I first read it, not just skipping around. It's really fun to look at all the breadcrumbs and the clues. But it's also been a while that some of the particularities of the mystery and the events have been forgotten to me. So there, I am getting a bit of rediscovery where I'm like, oh, right. Like, that's how that works. Or that's what happens. So it's totally fresh. Now I'm like rereading this. Like, maybe I should go back and read all 27 volumes of 20th Century Boys, right? Like,
when did you read this for the first time again? Sorry.
Probably like 3 years ago. 4 years ago, even. No, three.
Okay. So it's like recent enough that you remember the big stuff, but that makes sense.
Yeah. I tend to not rewatch or reread things except for very specific, like,
it's not enough time in the world.
A couple anime series. Yeah. There's more content to consume.
Yeah. So you have to consume more content.
Getting back on this is a treat. So I definitely, it's igniting my drive to get to read like Billy Bat, which is an Urasawa work I haven't read yet. Really good. Next week we're doing chapters 24 through 47. That will bring us all the way to the end of volume 6. So that's just volumes 4, 5, and 6. So we're making this easy for you to follow along if you're reading on the volumes. And if you want to reach out and give us the deets on like Tezuka, right? If you've got really interesting info about Osamu Tezuka and his influence and that sort of thing, you can reach us at mechadoaboutnothing@gmail.com. That's the name of the podcast, @gmail.com. Our website is mechado.moe, and our Twitter account is @mechadoopodcast. Thank you, Dan.
Thank you, Ian.
Until next week, will you be able to survive?